Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
It's Tuesday, October 23rd, 2001. My name is Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to the LaRouche Connection. Last week on our broadcast, I reported on a statement that was released by Lyndon LaRouche through his LaRouche in 2004 presidential campaign, in which LaRouche warned of the danger of Israel functioning as a breakaway ally to carry out a military provocation in the Middle East that would lead very rapidly to a clash of civilizations conflict between the West and Islam. LaRouche warned that there were forces inside Israel, as well as within the financial oligarchy in Europe and the United States, that believe that such a clash of civilizations is the most efficient way for them to retain their power during this current period of grave economic and financial collapse, and where an emerging alliance of nations of Eurasia is looking to alternative policies, particularly those put forward by Mr. LaRouche himself in his call for Eurasian land bridge. Now, just days after LaRouche issued the warning of an Israeli breakaway ally, perhaps triggered by some kind of act of terrorism or perhaps even a political assassination of, say, Prime Minister Sharon himself, a prominent member of Sharon's cabinet, General Zevi, was murdered in Israel. The PFLP, a Damascus-based organization, claimed credit for the assassination. And now, as the result of those developments, we are in fact living out precisely the kind of breakaway ally threat that LaRouche warned about just days earlier. So here we are. The United States is engaged in a military operation in Afghanistan, ostensibly targeting Osama bin Laden, his Al-Qaeda organization, and the Taliban for elimination as the result of the attacks of September 11th. And we've got maneuvers by the Israelis and by those in the West who want the clash of civilizations to choose this critical, sensitive moment to force further military operations in the Middle East that would lead to an out-of-control explosion of warfare that would soon grip the entire planet. This danger cannot be underestimated, and it's going to take an extraordinary degree of pressure coming from the Bush administration in Washington and from allied governments around the world to make it clear to some of the crazy faction inside Israel, particularly within the Israeli Defense Force, that moving forward with the breakaway ally operation would be a devastating break in relations with the United States, and it would be an action that would be foolhardy because it would lead to the actual destruction of Israel itself. LaRouche issued a follow-on statement following the assassination of General Zevi, who had just resigned from the Sharon cabinet and was one of the most fanatical advocates of the mass expulsion of the Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, in which LaRouche raised the question of whether or not some elements in Israel itself may not have had a hand in the Zevi assassination. Because, in fact, those people in Israel pushing the clash of civilizations, their allies among people like Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Richard Perle, and others, it's their interests that are best served as the result of the provocation, the Zevi assassination, and the threat now that Israel will retaliate with an assassination of Arafat, perhaps, with targeted attacks against Syria or Lebanon. So this is the grave situation we face, and it's going to require extraordinary pressure to curb the fanatics and crazies in Israel and avoid this clash of civilizations. At the same time, however, even were the Bush administration and allied governments around the world to succeed in placing the kind of pressure on Sharon and others in Israel such that they refrain from the kind of actions that we're warning about here. This would not solve the problem. There are deeper, more long-term underlying issues on the table today. The global financial and economic breakdown process has reached an endgame phase to where leading elements within the financial oligarchy wish to see war, particularly war within the Eurasian region, as a way of retaining power and getting out of the financial crisis for which they find no viable solutions. There are viable solutions out there, but those solutions would require the end of the kind of colonial imperial system that these oligarchs wish to proffer. Now, the bulk of today's LaRouche Connection show will be devoted to a presentation that Lyndon LaRouche gave last month in Peru via teleconference to a large group of prominent Peruvian economists. In that speech, in the portion particularly that we're going to show you today, LaRouche's opening remarks, he develops in detail the urgency of implementing his call for a new Bretton Woods policy, a new international monetary system, and for the defining of the construction of the Eurasian land bridge as a critical mission for humanity to end this period of grave crisis and bring civilization back to the levels that were aspired to, particularly by the founding fathers of the American Republic and those who developed the original idea of these Eurasian development projects as a way of spreading Republican ideas throughout that large portion of the planet. Following the LaRouche remarks in Peru, we will also continue to show some of the dialogue that LaRouche had with participants in the Labor Day 2001 conference that took place in Northern Virginia.
Good afternoon, dear Lynn. For me, it's a great honor and to present you before this distinguished audience. As you all are aware, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche is a great statesman, and he is the founding contributing editor of our magazine, Executive Intelligence Review. In addition to that, Mr. LaRouche is a Democratic Party pre-candidate for the presidency of the United States for the year 2004. I would like to thank you, Lynn, for granting us this time, because we know that your views and your advice at this moment is now more than ever needed and solicited from all parts of the world, so we know how valuable your time is. Before presenting it to the auditorium, I would like to simply recall a few words of what Friedrich Schiller said, which is that there are great moments in history which sometimes find a people that are too small for those moments. So, Lynn, once again, I would like to thank you for your time and leave you with an auditorium paying close attention to what your words are today. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lyndon LaRouche from the United States.
There are several things we should go through in series. First of all, the crisis. We're in the final breakdown phase of the existing world monetary and financial system. Not one part of it, but essentially all of it. That means the Americas, it means Europe, it means most of Eurasia, it means the world. Nothing can be done to save this system in its present form. It will go into a phase of disintegration during the present and the next quarter, before the beginning of the year. It may limp along in some form after the first of the year, but the system is essentially finished and cannot be preserved in its present form with its present institutions. This is also because of this crisis. It's also a very dangerous period in history in other respects. We have now the threat of generally spreading warfare throughout the world, particularly since the September 11th terrorist attacks in the United States, which are largely an internal operation, but obviously may have involved elements from other parts of the world as participants in the operation. We have not seen the end of it. No one has stopped the terrorists. No one has identified yet the terrorists, the actual ones. So they're sitting there ready to strike again. Now, this is not unusual in history for times of great financial and economic crisis. For example, 1932, 1933, we had a world crisis which at that point centered on Germany, because Germany was a pivot strategically of the effects of the crisis. At that point, you had in Germany an effort to stop Hitler from inside Germany. This effort was led by a chancellor of Germany, von Schleicher, Kurt von Schleicher. At that point, certain bankers in London, headed by the former Bank of England head Montague Norman, and by groups in New York City, including the Harriman interest, including the grandfather of the present president of the United States, Prescott Bush. These people, with Norman, with people like Schacht in Germany, with the von Schroeder banking interests, with von Papen, conspired to overthrow the von Schleicher government, which was done on the 28th of January, 1932. On the 30th of January, at the instigation of U.S. bankers, Norman and Schacht, Hitler was put into power in Germany as a chancellor. His power was not complete at that point. A month later, the Reichstag, the parliament of Germany, was burned down in what would be called a terrorist incident. Immediately, the Nazi Party took measures to declare emergency laws, and then the parliament enacted new laws extending the emergency. Less than a month later, Helmut Schacht became head of the Reichsbank and became the controller of the arms drive of Germany leading toward World War II, which is already planned. We're in such a time of crisis now. Danger. Coup d'etats, overthrows of governments, revolutions, violence, terrorism are the characteristic of a period in which a financial system collapses. Because it's a time of desperate men. You have men who have dominated the world with the present financial system. That system is now doomed. They're desperate. They're blind to reality. And they're determined to hold on to their power by any means possible at this time. They don't care about the future. They care about what they consider their way of life, their power, their commanding position in world affairs. So therefore, there's a struggle between some of these financial interests who refuse to face reality because they don't wish to, and the interests of sovereign nation states and peoples. It's a dangerous period. My concern is to do several things. First of all, to try to bring together forces which, as political forces internationally, including governments and others, will bring this danger to an end. Secondly, we must have a reform of the international financial and monetary system immediately. This means bankruptcy reorganization. Now, most of you probably are familiar with the procedures for bankruptcy organization applying to corporations, to large firms. But the bankruptcy of a government, and we're going to have many bankrupt governments around the world in the coming period, in South America and elsewhere, is inevitable. It can't be prevented. The debts are beyond any possible means of paying the debts. Therefore, a state of bankruptcy will exist. But this is bigger than a bankruptcy of government. This is the bankruptcy of a world system, a world financial system, the IMF system. And therefore, you must have a concert of power, of political power, which has the authority to put an entire international monetary and financial system into bankruptcy reorganization. The principles are not much different than they are for the bankruptcy of an important firm in a nation. There are certain firms you do not want to have collapse at any cost because they're too important to the country. And therefore, somehow you will arrange that these firms will continue to function because they perform an essential function for the nation. When you're dealing with the bankruptcy of a nation, the authority of this principle is even stronger. You cannot bankrupt a nation. You cannot foreclose on a nation. That would be mass murder. You must keep the essential institutions of the nation functioning. You must keep the levels of employment high. You must keep all essential institutions functioning. You must have a program for recovery. when you have an international crisis of this type, an international financial and monetary system, you have a similar situation. You cannot liquidate countries. You cannot decide which country is going to survive or not. All nations must survive, and they must survive together. But most of the debts will never be paid. And really, they shouldn't be paid, because most of the debt was not earned honestly. With the system established in 1971, with the collapse of the old Bretton Woods system, the debts of many parts of the world, as in Ibero-America, for example, the nations of Central and South America have paid more on the debt they owed as of 1971, far more than they owed. And they have far greater debts today than those they owed at the beginning. Much of this debt was absolutely fraudulent. In an attempt to maintain the system, vast amounts of credit have been poured into things that should not have been subsidized. And this now is debt. We have the international derivative speculation, more debt. We have hundreds of trillions of dollars of above board and below and secret or hidden debt around the world, which can never be paid at the present level of about $42 trillion equivalent of total world product. You can't pay the debt out of that amount of total product. And the amount of total product produced is collapsing. In the United States, we have collapse, collapse, collapse every day. New firms are cutting back 10%, 20%, 30% of their employment. It goes on and on. In Europe, it's the same. Around much of the world, it's the same. So the means to pay this debt does not exist. So we have to put the entire financial system into bankruptcy reorganization, cancel whole categories of debt, freeze other kinds of debt, that is, suspend any interest accrual and so forth on this debt. But nonetheless, keep banks open because they're essential, keep governments functioning, keep pensions paid, keep the economy moving. That we can do. We did something similar in the United States in 1933 under Franklin Roosevelt and beyond. That's a precedent. We know how to use that precedent for today. We formed at the end of World War II a monetary system, the Bretton Woods system, which worked in the parts of the world for which it was working. It worked. Not perfectly, but it succeeded. The world under the IMF system that was part of it grew. The incomes of people grew. The economy grew. Conditions became better. Despite all the things that were wrong, it worked. We can go back to that kind of thinking, starting from scratch with a new monetary system and a new financial system, and we can live. But we need something else. We need a growth program. The system made a lot of mistakes. The system is now bankrupt. In fact, most bankruptcies, somebody, the management, made a mistake. So you reorganize the management, bring in competent management, and use as a model things that did work as a way to start the economy of the firm or the country going. What are these projects? Well, first of all, we must create large amounts of public credit in most parts of the world, which will have the effect of increasing employment. That is, the state would use the authority of the sovereign nation state to create sovereign state credit, which will then be used to create employment in essential areas of employment that can be organized. This will be, to a large degree, infrastructure. It will be as much as possible reviving industries that have been closed or partly closed, which should be reopened. Because we cannot collapse the level of production of wealth in countries. We must do precisely the opposite. We must increase the production of wealth in every possible way. We must manage it, of course, but we must increase employment and production. Fiscal austerity methods are suicide. They're murder. Fiscal austerity as a method must be canceled. No more bleeding economies to try to roll over debts. It won't work. You'll destroy civilization if you try. But we need special projects which will do this. Now, we have one class of project which is immediately available to all governments. It's called basic economic infrastructure. There are always water systems, transportation systems, sanitation systems, healthcare facilities, and so forth. These things are always needed. Governments have well-defined projects, every government does, of things that need to be done that should be done, including the increase of production of power. In Peru, for example, you have water potential of development of water resources, which is crucial for the country, for its future. These things can be done immediately, as we used to do it in the United States with the military civil corps of engineers, to launch large-scale projects conducted by engineering groups, sometimes as military employees, sometimes as civilians working with military groups, and so forth. We built large-scale infrastructure. By building the large-scale infrastructure, we put people to work, useful work. These people were paid. They bought goods for their families. Communities prospered as a result of the infrastructure works. Subcontractors would obtain contracts to assist and participate in large-scale infrastructure, and the economies would grow. But we also need something more. We need two other things. First of all, we need the obvious. We have in Eurasia today a program which I've called a Eurasian land bridge, and my associates and I call this. It is now, in a sense, being adopted or in the process of being adopted in Eurasia. That is, Russia, China, other countries are coming together in cooperation around large-scale development projects, including transportation projects. Modern types of rail transport, including in China, magnetic levitation rail systems, are now being introduced. The idea is to create from the Atlantic to the Pacific a system of communication and development which enables us to take the areas of Central Asia, which are wealthy in terms of natural resources, but poor in development. And by introducing development across this area and transportation, we can make this an area of growth. And this would mean that countries such as Japan or Western Europe, and countries which normally were producing high technology capital goods, will find in this arrangement a market for increasing flows of production of goods into countries like those of Central, South, and East Asia. China, for example, is a great market if the proper kinds of assistance are given to it. A great internal development. This area contains the largest population of the world, part of the world's population. So this is a great opportunity. If, as is also being proposed, if from Eurasia, not only do the Americas participate in the market in Eurasia, not only if Americans participate in the market which will also develop in Africa for development, but there will be the building of a bridge, a tunneled bridge from Siberia to Alaska. That bridge will come down through the Americas, through Central America, into South America, all the way to Tierra del Fuego, Cape Horn, to unify the Eurasia in that way and in other ways with the Americas. We have in South America, in particular, we have large areas which are undeveloped, lack of infrastructure to develop them, with vast resources. Patagonia, for example, vast resources. Other parts of South America, vast resources, undeveloped. We have to convert the opportunity of development of these areas with their resources to convert that into a great market for investment. Now, we need to do something else. We need to have some science driver programs for the world as a whole. We need to set some objectives in terms of scientific objectives, new technologies, breakthroughs, new forms of energy, higher density forms of energy. These kinds of things we must have. We must use our universities and develop our universities to produce the cadres for these projects, to produce the skilled people to implement them, to to do the scientific research which will feed these kinds of scientific projects. And in that way, we can create a new kind of national economy. Not really new, but a qualitative improvement. If you look at the history of mankind, especially modern European civilization, the history of mankind is based on something in which where man differs absolutely from all animal forms of life. Man is the only creature which can discover a universal physical principle, can replicate that discovery in the minds of other people, can cooperate to use those principles to increase man's power over nature. Through this means, man is able to increase the productive powers of labor, to improve the demographic characteristics of population, to increase the potential size of populations that can be supported, raise the standard of living, and conquer areas which could not have been conquered beforehand. Why don't we just take that lesson, especially of modern society, and use that to reform our economies? That is, mobilize our universities and educational systems as science driver institutions, where old discoveries are reenacted for the students, where research is done on new principles, where the research work on new principles is done together with engineering programs to test new principles, to convert them into new technologies which can be used, to connect our economies, the productive sector of the economy, with these university centers in order to create an economy in which we are increasing the percentile of the labor force which is employed in fundamental research and in engineering, in creating new technologies. To increase the percentile of the population employed in industries which are of high technology operatives, who are able to assimilate an outpouring of new advanced technologies to make them real and to bring them into general practice. So these, I think, are the things which we should do at this time. These are the things which can lead us out of the world mess. What we need is essentially the political will to understand that this has to be done.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
To bring nations together and other forces to say, we are going to put the system into financial reorganization, into bankruptcy reorganization. We're going to generate masses of public credit by governments and by cooperation among governments to expand employment, especially productive employment, on a world scale in each country. We're going to take other measures to promote the expansion of employment in useful forms of production. We're going to maintain social stability and the general welfare. Now we're going to reach out beyond that to pioneer in great infrastructure projects, which will be transcontinental in their significance, to unite the continents, to unify the human race in cooperation. We must mobilize our population around the theme of education, of scientific education, to elevate the meaning of nation state to sovereign states which are concentrating on developing their populations through education to become science driver economies, to upgrade the quality of work for which people are employed, and to create a kind of world which we've been trying to build ever since about the 15th century in Europe with the great Renaissance there. I think that we have to say we've come to a time where humanity faces the greatest danger that the human race has ever faced in all known history to date, right now. We're in a period where if we don't do something to correct the problems, we could go into a new dark age of all civilization. We're vulnerable now. We don't have the resources we used to have to live through a depression. The rate of death, which will result from a continuation of this collapse with no solution, would amount to a new dark age for humanity. But looking at the danger of great wars, a new dark age, and great convulsions and chaos, perhaps this will alert us to the fact that we cannot behave as children anymore. We have to become adults. We cannot think about our convenience, our personal interest in a narrow way or a silly way. We've got to think about what are we doing about a future humanity, our children, our grandchildren, who are threatened by this great crisis. We're becoming older. In the course of time, we'll die. What are we going to leave to those who come after us? Are we going to leave a dark age, or are we going to be the giants who created the opportunity for not only a revival and preservation of civilization, but who in our time did something of which we can be proud in the eyes of our deceased ancestors, something of which we can be proud in the eyes of those who come after us? We must use the great crisis and the fear it strikes in many people as an incentive to grow up, to grow out of small-mindedness, and to have the imagination to see solutions, and to devote our lives to the purpose of bringing those solutions into being, so that when we die, we will be able to say, we lived, and it was good. Thank you.
Gracias.
Now let's turn to the Labor Day 2001 conference that took place in Northern Virginia, attended by more than 1,000 political activists from around the United States, and we bring you more of the dialogue between LaRouche and that group of prominent American citizens.
Hi, Lynn. I'm Wesley Irwin from Seattle. My question is, true spirituality, communicating with God, can only be achieved through a centeredness in self, in inner peace and inner security. And I feel the greatest hindrance in our becoming great organizers and leaders is in this area. I mean that if one does not have a personal spiritual awareness where they stand with God and the universe, then real mental clarity is not possible. And if you are not centered within yourself and do not have clarity in your own mind, you cannot possibly accurately read what is going on in someone else's, thus making your organizing ineffective and leadership skills obsolete. So I'm wondering what your method for finding your spiritual clarity, you know, how you get in touch with the divine is, and also what method you would suggest in transforming our organizers into spiritual leaders.
Well, first, I've answered, actually, I should clarify, perhaps, but I've answered the question many times. There is no such thing as a distinctly religious way of approaching that question. The only reason it comes up is because we live in a society which is backward, petty, and where people are so occupied with the here and now, so occupied with what they, the opinions of their neighbors and things like that, that they can't think clearly and don't lack, and they lack the motivation of a great leader. The term divine cannot be separated from the proper understanding of the term sublime, as Helganshur referred to it today. It's the same thing. The sublime is simply this, is that we talked about this afternoon in the, with a group of people who are young people working. You have a society is systemically sick, as this society is. The sickness is not only in the economic system, it's a system which is self-doomed in its present form. Nothing can protect or save this system in its present form. It just can't be done. This is, but this is not only true of economic policy, this is also true of personal policy. People live terrible lives. They live in the here and now. They live in small. They talk about my community. They talk about my family interests. They talk about my experience. They talk about my interests. They're not sublime. That's a systemically sick society. The true sublime, the true personality, is known by the great heroes of history as the example. The hero is a person who, faced with a systemic crisis of his society, in the first instance, is capable of putting his life and much more at personal risk, not for the pleasure of putting his life at risk, but to give his meaning, life meaning. See, if you go through life and you get a lot of money, you have a lot of pleasure, you have all these other gratifications, you never violate the single issue commandments, you are, as the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, nothing. And when you die, nothing ends. However, if you, in your own way, with your own sense of what the mission is that is given to you because of what position you occupy, who you are, and the problems before you, if you are capable of acting in that way and in proportion, as Paul describes this as agape in 1 Corinthians 13, as also is described by Plato, as agape out of the mouth of Socrates in the Republic. It's actually the second book. This conception of man, that we, this is what the sublime is. This is what the divine is. Anything else is not. The problem we have in this country is religious nuts running around being inspired. Inspired by the idea that if the Battle of Armageddon should break out tomorrow, they won't have to pay next month's rent. That's their religiosity. They're that of Pat Robertson or Falwell or the current Attorney General of the United States. That's their passion. That's their religion. It's a cult, an evil cult. And often in the United States, little people, in order to avoid facing the reality of the worthlessness of the lives they're living, where nothing ends at the end, invent religions to conform to the delusion of the corrupt way in which they're living. They say, therefore, you've got to get with Jesus. Well, that's not Christianity. Though that's the Jonathan Edwards school, which you'll hear something tonight from Stanley Ezrael. See, we are human, as I said yesterday. We are a human. What does it mean to be human? We're distinct from the animals. Why? How? How do we know that? Through cognition. We are capable, as no animal can, of reenacting in our own mind discoveries such as a principle, such as those of Archimedes 2,200 years ago, 2,300 years ago now. We're capable of reliving that thought not as something words learned, not as a formula learned, but reliving the experience from paradox to solution and verification, the mental experience that transpired in the cognitive processes of Archimedes 2,300 years ago. That's what makes us human. When we have a memory, if you really study and rather than learning, if you have a memory of the actual thoughts which pass through the mind of somebody who died centuries or longer ago, then that person lives in your mind. That is, the living process that is your mind is capable of reawakening and bringing forth exactly what occurred in the mind of that discoverer of a great principle a long time ago. In the same way, the great dramatist, the great classical dramatist, presents real history or a legendary history on a stage with precise, accurate, historical specificity. If, for example, in military training, the senior officers are trained by doing what? By reliving in the specificity of the times they occurred the great events of military history and history in general. Therefore, they are, in a sense, reliving and recapturing the qualities of the mind. As, for example, Lazar Carnot captured the mind of Vauban. And if you go to parts in France, as I went to Neuf-Brisach, and you can stand there, and with the help of Lazar Carnot's work, you can understand exactly what you're looking at. You can see the thoughts passing through the mind of Vauban as he designed this fortress, which the Austro-Hungarians never dared try to pass. And so there are many ways, in the classical stage, in history, military history, other ways, science, we are capable of reliving the actual ideas that developed in the mind of someone who is long deceased. Thus, their mind, in that degree and in that form, lives within ours. The educated, cultivated mind is a person who has many such personalities living presently, resident in his mind. In the same sense, as I've described it often, that Raphael Sanzio, in his School of Athens mural, portrays actual characters, including himself, in that portrait, in that image. These are people, most of whom had lived at somewhat different chronological times, but who interacted in terms of ideas. Therefore, if you are an educated person, you have the minds of many historical figures and others living in your mind. If you have a great teacher in the school, that's a very rare experience these days, but we did have a few of these around when I was younger. Then the image of the great teacher teaching, if it's cognitive, lives in your mind with that teacher. Your relationship to Archimedes is like that of a relationship to a teacher who has put you through the experience of acting out the act of discovery which they're presenting to you. Right. Therefore, in this way, what is divinity? What is the sublime? If our relationship to humanity is in those terms, if we see humanity in terms of a sea of faces, of cognitive discoveries, of children learning in the sense of cognition, developing, if we see the history of man unfolding in these terms, if we see the ideas on which we depend today that we've acquired in that fashion, and if we look forward to the future, and first of all, we're concerned that the future shall exist, we're concerned that we do for the future what the best of the past have done for us. Then you look at your life as a brief passage between birth and death, a very brief time. The processes of history unfold over generations, sometimes over centuries. If you want to understand history, you have to think in terms of centuries. If you understand European civilization, you have to think of it in its globally extended form. You have to think of its development from its foundation and roots in ancient classical Greece. You have to think of the planet historically in the same way. You think of mankind. You're a part of mankind. You absorb mankind in what you recreate in yourself. You act with that as your conscience. You look to the present and the future that comes out of the present, and you say, therefore, with the task before me, I must act so. Now, this has a very precise theological significance. In the realm of ideas, chronological clock time does not exist. Sequence exists. The sequence is the sequence of cognitive ideas. That is, ideas of universal principle. The only thing that happens is one principle is essential as the prelude to the discovery of another. That is the sense of time. For example, a great composer and a great performer in music composes a poem or a piece of classical music as if at an instant. No performer performs notes by notes. As I would have wanted to warn our dear friend Leah last night, always when you, before you perform a score of music, make sure there are no mouse tracks on the score which you play as notes. You don't play note by note. You play the composition from beginning to end with a certain attack, knowing the end before you get to the beginning, and neither the end of the beginning or the composition. It's the process which unites the one as if in a single act of thought. You don't know a musical composition unless you know it as a single act of thought. For example, the Brahms Fourth Symphony. You don't know it unless you know it as a single act of thought. Otherwise, you couldn't try to conduct it. You'd create a disaster. And the same thing is true with great classical poetry. Single act of thought. And the function of great classical art is to help your mind understand that about history. You have to think about history in terms of single acts of thought, the processes unfolding, and think about what you're doing to shape that process. Find your indispensable role in the process and play it out at whatever risk it takes. Because if you die in the process of fulfilling your mission, you shall live in history. If you avoid your mission for the sake of perpetuating your life, you will lose it. To save your life, you may lose it. Not that you should die. I don't recommend it to anyone. I've met few people who might be tempted by that. Maybe they should just go away and hide. Don't imprison them. Just tell them to go away and hide. So that's the point. It's the essence of that that leads to something else. Is the Christians in particular think of the individual, I think of the idea of immortality as it was defined, for example, by Socrates in the Phaedo, as it was described in the treatment of that under the Phaedon title in German by Moses Mendelssohn, the immortality of the soul. As taken up by Socrates, Plato and Socrates, as taken up again the same exact subject by Moses Mendelssohn. The immortality of the soul. What is the immortality of the soul? If I act now as a cognitive being, I represent the history before me, embodied in me, and I represent what I transmit from that with my contributions to the future. Therefore, wherever man exists, past, present, future, I exist. And that is the immortality of the soul. That is the divinity, sense of divinity. That is the sense of the sublime. But to do that, to get that sense of the sublime, you have to do a certain amount of work. You have to develop that view of mankind in yourself. If you think of man as the empiricists teach or otherwise, you'll never get it. All great people in history, sometimes flawed people, have some sense of that. All of the true great heroes of history have precisely that sense. And what is needed right now is a few big heroes, of course, but a lot of little ones.
Next questioner is Bill Ferguson.
Okay. Well, I've been running this campaign for Congress up in the Boston area, and it's the most fun I've had in a long time, going along with what you said yesterday about having fun. And well, I have three things that I wanted to bring up. Number one, I think following what Helga said this morning, somebody should get me the lyrics to Que Sera Sera so we can put together a song. Second, I've been in about 11 public debates as a candidate, and in the next 3 days or 4 days, there's going to be about 14 more. It's been a big opportunity to get the LaRouche program out and freak out a lot of people in the media to just keep repeating LaRouche was right and you don't know what you're talking about, you know, over and over again, and hammering away at the issue of the depression. I wanted to get your authorization, though, for a certain answer, because the first set of debates that didn't include me were on, like, televised, and these ones, they're terrible because the questioners don't want any bit of reality to come out, and they ask really stupid questions, like about, you know, gay rights and abortion, and nothing about the economy whatsoever. Now, in one of these debates, they asked the question that since the organizers of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in South Boston don't allow homosexuals to march, would you as congressman march in that parade if you were invited, or would you stay out and protest? Now, I think this is going to come up or something in this realm, because there's a lot of nice people in Boston that are into this sort of thing. So what my response to that would be that certainly I would march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade. In fact, I would ride upon a very large float wearing a bright green kilt, and the float would say, LaRouche says, the only queen you should beat up is the Queen of England. So do I have authorization for that? Will that work? Okay.
Well, I don't know. That's kind of interesting. Let me think about that. I think there are certain circumstances in which it's appropriate, but under some circumstances, you will not get any reaction you want at all. What you want to do is probably it's a little more insidious, would be more effective. Like, you know, well, the only queen I would think of beating up offhand, but she's already dead, Victoria. Okay. You have to recognize the reality of the psychological situation globally. We are in the worst systemic crisis of all modern history. There's nothing to compare in European experience with the present crisis as it's now in the process of unfolding. In all modern history since the 14th century New Dark Age. If we do not succeed in our mission, the population of this planet will very rapidly drop to less than 1 billion people. It's inevitable. If you look at the actual figures, if you look at what it takes to sustain populations, if you look at the collapse of infrastructure, if you look at all the inevitable things that are out there cranking out if present policies are continued, we are on the verge. First of all, if there's not a new Bretton Woods exactly as I prescribe it, you could forget this planet. You suppose that the ideas of Volcker and Rohatyn and other pigs, they're not edible, but they're pigs. If they were to prevail with their fake new Bretton Woods, with their compromise, and if we go into the crisis that is going to occur under those conditions, with their hegemony is considered the only alternative, then I can guarantee you the chain reaction of financial and other collapse around this planet will plunge the planet very soon into a prolonged new dark age. Mass death in the United States and elsewhere simply because of so-called environmental conditions caused by the collapse.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.